as well as some discussion on the 2008 legislative session. There'll also be a chance for us to talk about some of the upcoming meetings. We have a couple of tours that I believe that are in planning stage and questions on that, and just any other reflections that you'd like to share as well. It's our intent to be done no later than 2:30. We can take the subcommittee updates in any order that you wish, and I know a couple of you indicated a time concern, so let me know if that's the case. Otherwise, Senator Olsen, we could start with you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would appreciate that. Well, first of all, we've had one meeting of the subcommittee on student transportation, and I think that it went very well, but I'm really looking forward to a meeting we're having on Friday where, first of all, I guess we've really been looking at these Type 3 licenses and where we should go with that, or the Type 3 vehicles. And I guess my inclination is that we should have some kind of differentiated license. Right now, you don't even need a C. You could drive them with a D, which is your basic license. And there's no endorsement, and people aren't subject to drug and alcohol screening like a typical bus driver. So I think that personally I'm kind of, from the testimony that we've had from Captain Urquhart and some of the folks from MnDOT or the Department of Public Safety that do the bus inspections, I guess where I'm hoping to go with this, and I have to say I really appreciate you doing these subcommittees, because it seems like we're really doing kind of boots on the ground kind of work in different, many different areas. So thank you for that. But I think we've kind of stumbled upon an area that's been underregulated. And I think what the concern with that is that we're putting our kids at risk. So I guess I'm leaning towards an additional license than that has a separate endorsement, maybe not the same as a school bus endorsement, but some kind of training that, you know, you're operating a vehicle transporting students, you need something, not just jump in the vehicle and drive away. And also the ability for drug and alcohol testing. On Friday, we're going to have Amanda Berglund's parents are going to be speaking to the committee, and I suspect that will be very moving testimony. Amanda Berglund was the young woman who was killed on her way home from school. It was a contracted minivan that was transporting her back towards her home in Scandia, I believe. And the minivan plowed into the back of a Forest Lake school bus. And she was killed and the driver was killed. And so we were certainly pursuing concerns in this area before this accident happened. But this accident really brought to, I think, kind of the forefront that we've got to look at these vehicles and who's driving them. And that's something else that came out in our first committee hearing, was that physically I think our buses are in good shape. Our inspection program really does do a good job. And we heard concerns from Captain Urquhart that the real issue is looking at the drivers, the human error, the human side of transporting our students. So I'm looking forward to him having some ideas, hopefully to present to us on Friday. And then I guess that's kind of where we're heading. So okay. Looking at different kind of licensing for Type 3 license and endorsements. And also, because statewide there's 12 inspectors for 13,000 school buses, and they're saying that that's fine. They're able to inspect them on an annual basis at that rate. But it seems to me that we're beyond the physical capacity of the bus. That's really not the problem. The buses have good brakes. They have good lights. You know, they're pretty safe. The issue is maybe looking at more with more scrutiny at the drivers and their records and those kinds of things.
Okay, very good. Questions of Senator Olsen? Senator Rommel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is this on?
Yes.
Senator Olsen, my husband's a school bus driver, and they have extensive training every year and random drug testing in the school district. So I'm not too sure what else you're looking for.
I'm not going to use him as an example, but if a driver had a was arrested for a marijuana possession, and it wasn't while he was driving, so it wouldn't be on his driver's record. It's my understanding then that a criminal record doesn't show up on their record. Like a driving violation will show up on their record twice a year, I believe. Their motor vehicle driving record is looked over. So the problem isn't with driving the big buses. It's the type 3, where school districts, a lot of school districts contract these smaller buses or with companies to transport maybe one or two students to Amanda Berglund was hard of hearing, so she was being transferred to a school in St. Paul that had a really good hearing program. So Forest Lake School District contracted with this company that drove her. So that was different scrutiny. They're under different scrutiny than your husband as a driver. They're under no scrutiny, actually. So that's what we want to change. We want to have the type 3s, and it's true, a type 3 operated by a school district, they're probably subject to the same training as their drivers of their big buses. But a lot of these companies that have contract or do these kind of contracts for a very small number of students, they're not subject to that. They may do it as a company policy, but there's no law saying they have to.
The only reason I'm asking is, the burden on school districts that are already very scrupulous about this kind of background check. He does drive a type 3 bus, but it's within the school district's jurisdiction. It's their own bus. But so you're limiting it to, or are you going to, is it across the board? Are you going to be asking for this for just independent?
No, providers? I'd like to see it across the board because, that school district may do a real good job, having their type 3 people have the training that their other drivers have, but another school district may not. So I'm interested in seeing it go for all type 3 operators.
Thank you. Further questions? I know that you had a lot of people at the first hearing. There'll be a great deal of visibility this Friday, I believe, on the testimony. You're also a member of the Transportation Committee.
Yes.
Senator Murphy's, and presumably have the dialogue with Senator Murphy too, as any recommendation, if it goes through ultimately through the full committee, would be re-referred to his.
Mr. Chair, that's a good point, because this is kind of an orphan bill, because I suspect it would be introduced in the Education Committee, but it does need to travel through transportation. And last year, the school bus safety stuff ended up in transportation. And so I've talked to Senator Murphy about this, and I will continue to. One of the big concerns that I believe he has is that the State Patrol is probably understaffed as it is. And to designate more Department of Public Safety or State Patrol people towards bus inspections and looking at drivers' records, where would we get the money to hire those people, and are we pulling them off the street? So those are some unanswered questions that we need to address. So I'm kind of looking at phasing this. Okay. At this point in time, I think if we can address the Type 3 vehicles and then maybe future legislation, because a lot of the funding by the State Patrol comes actually out of the gas tax. So if the transportation bill moves, there may be an opportunity for having more inspectors for the buses. But as it is, I think that I'll look at the inspection of driver's records and stuff as future legislation, not something dealt with now.
But you'll stay focused on student safety, protection, and if it's a phase-in, so be it, but what the consequences would be if you did not have such recommendations as well. Which
That's
we usually
it in
hear
a nutshell.
About each time there's an accident.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Our work group was called Expectations and Accountability, And what we set out to do was to ask how we align or bridge our work in the E-12 system with post-secondary expectations. What are the indicators that young people are leaving our schools, that they will have the academic preparation as well as the attitudes and skills needed to not only complete college but to enter the workforce? How accountable is our accountability system? The work group was not in any way looking at trying to amend or address the No Child Left Behind requirements that are currently on the report card. Our report card is 5 years old, and it seems like it's simply good practice to look at the tool that we're using and say, is it doing what we want it to do? And if not, or are there things we could change it to make it better? An accountability system for its own sake doesn't make any sense. The accountability system is to further excellence in our schools, equity among our schools, preparation for higher education and the work world, and also to ensure a balance of curriculum and preparation in the core academic areas. So our first hearing was held, I believe it was October 8th, and the purpose of that hearing was to establish a common understanding of the report card's components. And the Department of Education testified. They spent an hour going over the history of the report card, the components of the report card. A good deal of time was spent discussing the various types of data that the department has put in place and that are accessible, especially through the web. I think the phrase data warehouse was used a number of times, and many people commented on the fact, yes, there's lots of data, but not all of us know how to get at the data nor how to use the data once we get at it. At that same hearing, we had a number of superintendents testify, and we were asking them what works for them and what doesn't work for them. And some of the comments, I didn't bring them all with me, but some of the comments were pretty consistent. Superintendents were looking for a growth factor, and the department is working on that. Many of the superintendents do have a strong desire to see if we could do anything with the Northwest Education Assessment, the NWEAs, as a tool that might be considered. Physical education, world language, and the arts, counselors, those kinds of things that complete an education, they feel are not adequately dealt with on the report card. Some superintendents talked about it's an unintended consequence. For example, we report currently the salaries of teachers. If you're in a school district where you have been around for a long time and possibly have a shrinking population, your teachers tend to be older and more experienced, and so their salaries are higher. And then if you're in a growing school district, the teachers look at that because the statewide average is given, and they're saying, well, why aren't we earning that? Well, because there's no factoring in for experience. Many of the superintendents wanted to see some kind of context given that, for example, a flat number on whether it's testing or scores, that over the years, maybe 3 years ago it was this and today it's this, so that there's some kind of indicator over time. Otherwise, they're flat numbers that the general public knows nothing about. What do you do with this number? And I think some of the numbers that were mentioned were mobility in a district. Is it going up? Is it going down? Some superintendents would suggest, well, at least let's see what the trend is. One of the superintendents suggested that our accountability system, with the emphasis on testing, is a one-way system, that accountability goes two ways. Asking what are we doing to make sure that the districts can accomplish what they need to do. Should that be reported? Looking for flexibility. Every one of the superintendents that testified that day agreed that the star rating was something they were glad to see disappear. They thought it trivialized the impact and the importance of the data on the report card. They did not like ranking without context. Some of the superintendents said that the data that we're collecting is very complex, and it's difficult to distill down to a couple of numbers. One superintendent asked us to, and he was very forceful, to look at the purpose. The way he looks at the report card, he said it's more of a school profile than a report on how the schools are doing. And he suggested using the Baldrige Quality Improvement Plan, which would first define the purpose of the report card, second, ensure its accuracy, align the results by categories, and then show trends. So we got a lot of excellent suggestions from the first hearing on just the nature of the report card and how it is working for folks right now. Our second hearing was, I believe it was November, I can't remember the exact date, 7th, I think.
Yes.
We opened up the conversation and said, okay, what are the expectations out there? What do we, various groups, say we want from our schools? And based on what we want for our schools, is there a measure, is there an indicator that would let us know if we are providing, if we are reaching those? And that was a 4.5-hour hearing. So anybody who sat through those 4.5 hours, my compliments to you. I'm not going to go through because it was way too many people. Let me see if I can summarize. We broke the testimony into three groups. The first group of folks, and I can't find my notes. I had them here a minute ago. Reported to us on the whole child type expectations. We began with early childhood. I know it's here. Folks talking about if we're going to have a report card, we ought to be starting with, does the district, do the schools, do the parents in the district have access to quality early childhood education? Folks testified about things that relate to student engagement, a person reported on English language learners. What is the capacity of the school district to deal with English language learners? The arts were represented. So these first groups of testimony talked about other things that people want for their children, want for their schools, and they gave us suggestions about what might be indicators. The second group of folks we put together as the folks who are looking at the end in view. When our students leave our schools, what do we expect of them? And overall, we're calling that post-secondary readiness for post-secondary work. To complete at least 2 years of post-secondary work is an expectation that is now a high priority, it seems, in the state. And so what are we doing? What can we measure? What can we look at that will tell us if our students are moving in that direction? And so some of the suggestions had to do with what kind of course taking. Mr. Piquel from the university indicated that the strongest evidence of succeeding in college really can be measured by the level of mathematics that students take. Not that that's the only thing they should be taking, but if we look at the kind of course taking, whether they're taking advanced courses, whether they're taking AP courses or IB courses, others from the sector that looks at career and workforce readiness spoke about offerings that dual enrollment that lead to a licensure in one of the whether it's electricians or PMTs, and the kids that are getting ready for more vocational career type, career tech type of work. so that post-secondary, a lot of testimony on post-secondary readiness was the second part of the hearing. And then the last part of the hearing heard from a number of stakeholders, people who work in assessment, and reported to us about the kinds of outcomes from the various tests that we give our students and special education considerations. We heard also from the Teachers Association and from the PTA and from Growth and Justice. So we heard from a great many people who are looking at what we expect for our students in our schools, and they gave us ideas about what we might want to consider including on the report card. And as you can imagine, there's more on there than you can get on. One of the testifiers said, well, a report card should be 2 pages front and back, and it should be in 12-point type. So how do we get all these indicators on there, and what ones are valid and what ones make sense? Where we will go from here is on December 3rd, there will be another hearing where we are distilling the information. And my guess is that we will be coming forward with a plan to phase in some ideas. We have come up with a number of criteria that we will be used to judge whether or not something makes it to the report card. We're asking a few of the testifiers from the second hearing to help us look at their area of interest and use these criteria to help us find some of the indicators that are practical, you know, that actually do forward the intent of the expectation, and that are doable, that we can do it and that are affordable. We're not trying to reinvent the wheel, but we're simply trying to find things that are already out there that may be useful to parents. And I think that's another thing that may be happening at the third hearing, is to clarify what is the purpose of the report card, as distinct from the whole data warehouse that the department has put up for us. Not that that's going to go away, but the report card that most people use. I found it interesting that one of the superintendents said that he has yet to hear of a parent ever going onto the web and looking at the report card. And he's been a superintendent for quite a few years, for the whole duration of the report card. He never hears about parents using the report card. And he himself has never gone and looked at the report card until we asked him to testify. So we are trying to find something that will be very useful for parents and meaningful for parents, and also very fair and complete for the schools, and that will foster excellence in education.
Very good. And you're also involving the House as well.
Yes, this is a House and Senate committee, and it's been a challenge to get us together, but we're working together. We do hope, and in the next session, that we will have a bill that will hopefully make it through committee and make it through the floor.
At least your subcommittee, for sure.
And the subcommittee. I wanted to get through this committee, okay. And whatever other committees it gets through. That if we can come out with a more meaningful report card for folks, useful, so parents really can use it to make the decisions they have to make.
Great. We have some questions, Senator Michelle.
Actually, Mr. Chair, I don't mean to cut off any questions. I have 85 third graders in about 10 minutes,
okay.
which is even more intimidating than this group. Okay. But I wanted to make sure I tried to get an early childhood subcommittee update on the record, preferably before that. So yeah.
We'll accommodate that.
Thank you.
We can come back, I'm sure, and have questions if people want.
Okay.
Well, you're okay with that?
Oh,
come back
absolutely.
In. Yeah, Senator Michelle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Senator Rommel. And I think I'm cutting in front of Senator Torres-Ray, too.
It's perfectly fine.
But I am co-chairing the Early Childhood Subcommittee. Senator Bonoff sends her regards. She couldn't be here today. But let me give a brief overview and make a couple points. We've had two hearings of this subcommittee, one in October in North Minneapolis, where we concentrated on birth to three-year-olds and where they fit in the early childhood discussion. We had a second hearing in the Robbinsdale District on November 13th, concentrated on 3 to 5-year-olds then. And we have a third hearing set up for December 11th, at 10 a.m. down in St. James, 10 to noon in St. James, Minnesota. And
I believe Sarah Michelle, it is at 11, though?
Yeah, it's at 11.
Okay, 11 o'clock on the 11th.
For those that are,
there you go. Thank you for, and thank you, Gretchen, for an amazing job of juggling, not just our subcommittee, but all of these subcommittees. I should note that at the outset here. And Mr. Chair and members, I think there's also an assumption and a plan that we will have a fourth meeting in January here at the Capitol to kind of see where we go after taking in all this good information. And I think almost every member who's attending today's committee has been a part of this early childhood subcommittee. There's a lot of energy, Mr. Chair. I really think there's a bipartisan consensus to do something. The what has become somewhat difficult to define. Let me talk process a little bit. We have really made an effort with this subcommittee to reach out to the House. The House, as you may know, has an early childhood committee of its own, chaired by Representative Slawik. And so we have literally accommodated their committee, and they've been a part of these hearings as well. We've also worked with the Early Childhood Caucus, and there's a lot of overlap there between the education committees and these early childhood committees and members of the House and members of the Senate. But what I think, at least one of my conclusions would be that we've had some great testimony. There is certainly a wealth of evidence and reports and suggestions on early childhood. And I think what we haven't had enough of is discussions amongst members, amongst legislators, particularly between the House and the Senate. So we've really tried to use the subcommittee process as an opportunity to start that. I'm not going to claim we've finished that discussion. We've really just started it. But as you know, going back over the last several sessions, the House and the Senate don't always think the same way. And we've had different things we wanted to emphasize. There's the all-day kindergarten topic that comes into play. There's certainly a lot of financial and fiscal issues around this topic. So there's a lot for us to do, and I'm pleased at the level of discussion and candor, frankly, amongst House and Senate members. I think we need more of that, and I look forward to doing more of that as December and January roll on. We've also made a real serious attempt to involve the governor's office and the administration. Commissioner Segrin was a part of our first hearing in North Minneapolis. So I think we're off to a good start.
Questions? Senator Salzman.
Yes. Perhaps in addition to the report, was that I think that what's been very unique about this particular group is that after we have the hearing to gather over lunch and kind of debrief. And that's been very helpful because these hearings are obviously very important, but to have the discussion, and Senator Torres-Ray and Senator Olson had a coming together. We all were having this coming together moment of really talking about, you know, we may not agree on how to get there, but we all want to be there. And then finding, well, actually, we have more in common. And that's, I think, what's been very helpful and certainly on other committees that we've worked on as well in the, you know, with our subgroups. And so, you know, I really think that that's been, hear the information. The other sense I have is that in listening to all these different groups, I've sat back and started thinking, if I was a parent, there's all these different programs. There's a menu of programs out there, and I'm becoming confused with how would I access, or, you know, if I need to go to this program for this piece and over here for that, that sense of I'm getting a headache thinking about all these different options, what's best for me. So, I mean, that's not to say that's not a good thing to have, like all these different programs. But to really start to think about is a family that is maybe struggling or a child who is struggling, how do we connect them and find the appropriate services, and where's the efficiencies, and how can we do public-private partnerships? That seems to be something that I think is an up-and-coming trend. So how do we connect these programs also with our public schools? Because we've talked about the 3-to-3 model in our early literacy group, and that sort of the transition coordination. So it's not just about a 3-year-old program and a 4-year-old program, and then they go to kindergarten. It's where's the continuum of services so the child builds on a common program. So lots of questions, and now we're looking for maybe some direction and answers. So.
And further questions of Senator Michelle, who has to leave.
And I'll be back. I'll come back, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Well,
before he leaves, was one of the things you talked about was more access or how to make it more available and those kinds of things?
Yes. Mr. Chair, Senator Olsen, I actually think we will hear more about the access issue at our next meeting. Our first two hearings really focused on metro area, inner city, a first ring suburb, and the notion of transportation and the challenges that can cause to a family, and certainly cost is also another issue when it comes to access. But yes, and it we kind of have to wrestle with it on several fronts.
Thanks. We'll meet further when you return.
Thank you.
We have a request, Senator Rummel, to go to the achievement gap, and we're going to we'll get back on that discussion. Senator Torres-Wright.
So you want me to go? Okay.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. The committee that we are co-chairing with Senator Erickson Ropes is the achievement gap. And our charge was to examine ways to address achievement gap between different populations, to look at administrative responses to the achievement gap, and to perhaps suggest potential legislative solutions to reduce the achievement gap. What Senator Erickson Ropes and I decided to do early on was to really look at the information that was available to us and try to review different approaches that we could bring to this committee and to the public that are new. And so we didn't want to talk about things that you have heard again and again. And this was a tremendous challenge to us because what we found is that we were finding the same information posted in different websites and different people wanted to talk about pretty much the same thing. And that is that we have a significant problem in the state of Minnesota, that we have significant achievement gaps, and that there was a serious issue that the state was facing with respect to the gaps that certain districts face that are major gaps that are not reflective of the entire state of Minnesota, that we had high concentration of poverty, high concentration of children of color in certain communities, and that achievement gap tended to be reflected in those areas. So there's we're presenting right now. She just got here, so. I was just letting the committee know that we had the challenge of reviewing information and trying to figure out how we could really grasp information that was unique and that we didn't want to present information that you already knew. We wanted to present something new. Based on that reflection that we had at the beginning, we decided that we will approach this particular issue by looking into three particular components. One, to look at what is happening federally. We wanted to figure out if other states were doing something that we should review and present here. And we invited Carlos Valverde, who is the Achievement Gap Coordinator for NCSL. And he came here to present in our second committee. We also look at what is that we could review statewide. So we decided to ask the commissioner to come and present, and I will describe how these presentations were organized. So we decided to look at the federal picture. We wanted to look at the state picture, and we also wanted to look at the local districts. At the time that we were looking at these three different perspectives, we were also reviewing a number of papers that have been written, and we had really the privilege to connect with researchers that were doing incredible work locally and that have written extensively about achievement gap and have published their papers and are recognized, those papers are recognized nationally. So what we decided to do was to really look at how do we present that to the committee. In doing that, we have had two hearings. The first hearing, we invited commissioner from the Department of Education to present, and she gave an overview of the different approaches that are currently in place at the state level. And she focused her presentation on the Leave No Child Behind initiative and what the state is doing to implement the federal policy. She also gave an overview of the results of the MCA tests, and that was provided here. We have copies of that information for those who are interested. In that same hearing, we had the Minneapolis, both the St. Paul and the Minneapolis school districts, who are the largest, as you know, the largest districts in the state of Minnesota, facing perhaps some of the most challenging issues today in terms of numbers and really complex situations. And we also had the Minnesota Association of School Administrators who came and present. And we had an opportunity to hear a presentation that many of you have heard from Myron Orfield about the direct correlation between high concentration of poverty and housing and achievement gap. And all of that information is available. I don't want to go in depth because it'll take me a long time, and I know I don't have a lot of time. Then in the second presentation, Carlos Valverde from the National Conference of State Legislators gave us a perspective. What Carlos did for us was to really look at Minnesota and how Minnesota compares to the rest of the nation, and he gave an overview and placed Minnesota in the map. And for those of you who have reviewed this before already know that Minnesota has some of the highest disparities in the nation, and that Minnesota is the only state in the country that has an achievement gap between the white community and the Asian community in this country. So unlike most states where Asian children perform at the same level of white children, Minnesota is an exception. And he covered very interesting information with respect to the position of Minnesota, which is, I think, quite alarming. In that same hearing, we also heard from the McKenzie Group. This group just finished an extensive in-depth review of the Minneapolis School District and put together a strategic plan for the Minneapolis School District, concentrating on different aspects that the school board needs to address in order to deal with the achievement gap and other issues that are a problem for this, for the district right now. And finally, we heard from the Minnesota State Councils of Color, who have come together to put together a memorandum of agreement of collaboration, and they have determined that achievement gap is their priority number one for the next 5 years. And we are going to have one more hearing on December 3rd, and we're going to hear from the Minnesota Parent Teacher Association and another researcher that is well known nationally at the University of Minnesota, Dr. Sam Myers. He has invited Dr. Susan McCroy from Texas, who they have completed a study that actually is a very revealing study that speaks on an issue that is being discussed and is very controversial nationwide, which is the direct correlation between poverty and achievement gap. And they argue that there is no correlation between poverty and achievement gap. And we're going to hear from them. What we concluded, what we are concluding is that we have a lot of information that really gives us a clear understanding that we have a problem in Minnesota, but clearly we did not hear a specific ideas about what the solutions are. Until now we haven't heard people really talking specifically about what specific policies or programs need to be implemented that have been assessed and studied long-term. So we really don't know the impact. Issues that have been presented are as solutions and things that are being tested, and clearly issues that most researchers and districts and states are now testing are teacher quality, quality of instruction, class size, expectations, from administrative expectations to teachers' expectations to parents' expectations to community expectations. The correlation between child well-being and academic performance, parent involvement, early childhood education, and community support. Those are clear themes that come back again and again when we talk about how to deal with the achievement gap. So we have clearly heard about, we have heard about the problem. We have heard about local solutions. Experts identified local solutions. We have not heard about statewide solutions that have been really implemented over time. And so we really cannot assess whether those solutions or pilot projects have been implemented in a way that we can assess and conclude that they will work. What we heard is that one model will not fit the entire state of Minnesota, that it is very difficult to replicate models, that a model that may be working in Tennessee may not work here because communities are very unique and the needs of children are very unique. But there is an issue that we keep coming, we keep hearing again and again, and it seems to be an issue that brings people together, and there are more consensus around investing in early childhood education to address the achievement gap. That's clearly an issue that every state is working on right now, and they clearly see that the investment makes sense, particularly when we target resources in communities that are vulnerable. And that's where we are at right now, and our hope, we met, the three of us actually, with Senator Carlson and Senator Erickson Robes. We had a very frank conversation after our last hearing. And we would like to propose to our committee that we have a working session to really put our hands around this information about what we've learned and come up with a recommendation for this committee and for the Senate and hopefully for the House. And at this point, very preliminarily, what we are thinking is that we will propose perhaps some legislation this year to ask the state of Minnesota and the specific districts that right now face this challenge to come up with a specific strategic plan to address the achievement gap within the next 5 years. And so that in that process, we will initiate, we will really have an expectation that this issue will be addressed at the local level and that perhaps the solutions do not will not come from a statewide perspective because each district is facing different challenges, and that we may have to give the districts an opportunity to define those challenges, define solutions, and present a plan to address those solutions and present a request to the legislature to address those solutions, to implement those solutions. I think that's what we have so far.
Thank you. Senator Erickson-Ropes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I apologize for being a little bit late. I'm right in the middle of chairing a healthcare committee as we speak. So thank you, Senator Torres-Ray, for doing the overview. It was excellent. I would just simply like to add that we believed Senator Carlson, Torres, Ray, and myself, that it was critically important to involve the stakeholders in various groups in determining what the recommendations were going to be. That was one of the messages we'd heard over, but there's always groups of people coming up with the perfect solution, and here it is with a bow tied on, the package, and here's the recommendations. And then we tell people, here's your problem, here's how we think you need to solve it. And we really believe it's important to bring the communities of color and the department and all the different stakeholders that are affected by and concerned with the achievement gap together to come up with the solution that is going to fit for them. So if they're affected by the problem, they need to be part of the solution. Moving away from the top-down unilateral decision-making model to one that's more lateralized, where we include people who are on the job, in the streets, doing the work, and having had experiences with great successes, hearing from those people and having them help us identify what the recommendations are going to be.
Thank you. Questions from committee members? Oh, very good. And you also have members, I believe, from the House that have attended, or at least your first meeting, I saw some.
Yes. We have some members attending, but we haven't made an effort to really do it.
Okay. Has it been bicameral no. Effort to this point?
Mm-hmm. And you're floating the idea of districts coming up with a plan, a strategic plan for 5-year compliance for a reduction or elimination of the gap.
I think that's what we'd like to talk about with this broad stakeholder group. Actually go through perhaps a 4-hour or 6-hour workday where we look at all the information that's been presented, look at all the good ideas and suggestions, and review again some of the studies and points of success, and have people then really say, is this going to work for our community, and what do we think the next step has to be? Because until this point, it seems that these small groups of people here at the Capitol come up with the answers, and then we put it in legislation and roll it out, and it doesn't necessarily work with different cultures or different communities. So we want to have them decide with us and give us some really accurate recommendations about what they think is going to work and what they need, and then it's up to us to come up with the resources and legislation to back up a good plan.
Had you considered whether there might be a consequence if a district did not sufficiently reduce the achievement gap?
We haven't discussed that at this point.
Okay. Thank you very much for the update, and look forward to the upcoming meetings. And we will be allotting time pre-session for the full committee to further review the recommendations. So.
Thank you
very much.
Recommendation for a workshop or whatever it is, we will allot time for that. Okay, we'll return back to Senator Romo.
I was technically finished.
Oh, right, but in terms of any feedback and that you'd like to share, again, the big focus on the report card and expectations, various stakeholder groups, questions, comments.
Mr. Chair?
She tackles that big issue.
I was interested. I don't know if this was within the scope of your committee, but did you look at all like these NWA tests for the students?
There was at least one, maybe two people testifying about that. We've talked about it a good deal in preparing, and I have some thoughts about I don't know if it comes within the purview of this charge, but I have interest. I was going to approach the chair about possibly a hearing simply on the state of our testing. I was at one school district, and they had this wonderful grid that showed all the testing that goes on in the school district, starting from the No Child Left Behind federal, then the state-mandated tests, then the district-mandated tests, and then the school-mandated tests, and then the class, this grid of testing. And I think there, I think it would, at least for our own education, be helpful for us to have a better grasp on the nature of testing and then the kinds of testing we're doing and what we expect from those tests and where we're putting our emphases. So I think it's an excellent question, so I will approach the chair about whether or not we can do that.
Was that on number 12 font, both sides, or did it take up a whole wall? Or
No, it was the Miles View School District. It's a fold-out page, and he writes down the side, he lists the kinds of tests, and it's the various, he has it's a full chart. I could share it with you. It's very interesting. The impact on the student, the impact on schools, it looks at the cost, he looks at what it does or doesn't do in terms of student learning. It's very interesting.
I think that'd be interesting to get copies for the whole committee.
And I think folks in the House are also interested in, there was a lot of discussion about the Northwest testing, and I did sit in on the MDE had an accountability meeting last week, and I sat in on it, and that topic came up there, too. So it's certainly in the air. There's a lot of curiosity. I think we need to see on the table what's the difference, what's going on, what. I think we need to hear that.
Thank you.
Yes, and the answer is yes. And
thank you.
Please go ahead and recall that we did have a couple hours of testimony on testing, and I very clearly remember Superintendent Jennings and showing the calendar, you know, for his district and the distribution, and we continue to get feedback, and not against testing, but whether there's a more efficient way
spending the morning at the department last week. I mean, we're in a very interesting era where more and more there's, on the one hand, hopes for computerized testing, whether or not schools can accommodate that with the equipment they have and still use the technology they have for teaching so the kids are technologically savvy. And so there's a lot of things coming down in the future that we have to think about, then what we do for testing and how much of it. So I think it's a good topic to add. Yeah. Not that we have to do anything right now. The No Child Left Behind issues are still out there. So it's very complex. But I think at least get this NWA question out loud so we hear it fully.
Senator Torres-Ray, do you have a question?
Yes, I'm glad you just said that, yes, you can do the hearing, because I think I would really like to encourage the committee to have these hearings, because I just see from a personal experience that we are putting so much emphasis on testing. I don't have a copy of the grid, but I have two boys at home that complain about being tested every week. And it's interesting, because I think what is happening is that there is so much at stake in the schools right now and in the districts that children are having to take tests, preparing for the test so that they can have a test in the school so they can be tested at the state. And I think that we have a significant problem. I have tested my kids on this testing, and it's interesting that they don't know the concepts, but they know the right answer. They don't know what the answer actually means, but they know the answer because they are being trained on how to respond to a test without really knowing the concept. And this is very tragic, in my opinion. And we need to really understand and review what is that we are doing when we prepare our children to perform in a test and not to perform academically. So I am very interested in the work that you do in this area.
We'll follow up, and Senator Rummel will help prepare those plans. Senator Saltzman and Senator Olson will take your subcommittee next.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. We have had two meetings so far. The first meeting was sort of an overview to look at some of the models in literacy that have come to our attention and review them.
We had five different groups to testify. We heard about an overview of the age 3 to grade 3 model, which is getting quite a bit of attention right now, and talking again about continuity, where it's not just about getting 3-year-olds prepared for kindergarten, but what happens after that, because being able to read by grade 3 is just so very, very important. We heard about that. We also heard more about, we just talked about testing. Well, we've been listening to testing that, you know, a teacher likes to give, because if a test is used to see if the intervention is effective and really affects teaching, then it's a different kind of test. And just to kind of give you a brief example, and I used this at our hearing, was that why do we weigh cows? Everybody goes, what are you talking about? Why do we weigh cows? Well, you don't weigh a cow because the more you weigh it, it gains weight. You weigh a cow to see if you're feeding it enough so that it does gain weight. And there's probably other reasons too. But the issue is that if you use a simple test to assess a child, and also the child is able to see if he or she is making progress, then it's a good test. And it doesn't have to be a 3-hour test. It can be a simple way to really, like, you know, monitor a child's progress. So we heard a lot about that and how that's used to then problem solve and then discuss the appropriate strategies. We also heard from the RTI Center, which is a center that we funded in this last legislative session to develop training in a response to the intervention, the problem-solving model. And that program has been highly successful in that it's sort of a standing room only as they've gone around the state with these introductory all-day sessions. They're completely packed. And so, you know, schools and districts and teachers would really like to learn more about this. Then we also heard about a program, Reach Out and Read, and Lynn Burke is here today from Reach Out and Read. And that's a program that's sort of outside of the box of this program, but it's really working where a pediatrician during a well child checkup starts to introduce parents to literacy and books and reading. And it's a great program because, as we've talked about the birth to 3 models and programs that are, you know, sort of scattered around the state, they're very different. This is really a program that, you know, is really interesting because every child hopefully is going to have the well child checkup. And so making sure that all parents receive this sort of important message. So we'll be talking more about that. Perhaps Senator Olson would like to add to anything on that first meeting that struck you as significant.
No, that's fine. You're doing fine.
So perhaps we talk about our second visit, our field trip. Would you like to cover that?
Sure. Our second meeting was actually held up at Rush City. Field trip up to the St. Croix River Education District that we affectionately call SCRED. And there we saw, heard a presentation on the response to intervention and its impact on improving reading. Is it? I don't know if you've received our little report, but we also visited the Jacobson Elementary at Rush City and saw some of the good reading practice, teaching practices in operation. And we sat in on a meeting of the second grade teaching, the reading teachers team that reviewed the ongoing frequent reading assessment that is given to all of the students and determines which grouping or which teacher they will be working with, determines the effectiveness of the strategies that they're using, and makes adjustments to that to keep them on target to reach the goal of the number of words that they need to have command of, words per minute that they should be able to read by the time they finish second grade. It's a problem-solving model. They're following some instruction within the five reading strands, the phonemic awareness, phonics, and fluency, and on. But what was interesting to note was the engagement of the teachers working together, so that they and the assessment that assessed each individual student and worked on their progress. I think some of the things that we're working on, I couldn't help but believe that in Senator Torres raised concerns about the achievement gap. I think at the foundation is whether they are getting a good foundation in literacy. And so hopefully some of the things that we're working on and what's coming up in our next two might be also instructive or helpful toward that end as well.
Those were great trips because for folks who hadn't really seen this in action, it really ties things together. And Senator Olsen was there as well, and he's been there twice with us. So, and Senator Carlson came as well. So it was a very interesting field trip just to kind of see how this all works. And when you see a team working together like this, it just looks like, well, this just makes so much sense. And yet having the infrastructure, the training, the support from the principal, because you've got to be able to schedule classes so all the teachers have an opportunity to meet to do this important meeting is just great. The other thing, though, is we need to talk about the data, and that the data is showing that this model works. When we look at schools that have followed this model and seeing the children's achievement, it's just really, really remarkable. So, again, if we start earlier with the age three and we start to use this model of identifying children very early on who are not developing these critical skills, and we start to intervene with, you know, very simple techniques, but not everybody has these. So that leads to the next two meetings. Our next meeting is going to be on December 13th or 11th. Let's see, December 13th. And we've been listening to the professionals and listening to these different models, and we think it's important to bring parents in and stakeholders, consumers, students, to hear from them on for struggling readers what kind of techniques have worked with them and the interventions and the struggles they've gone to find appropriate instruction. So we'll be listening to them. And then we'll be having another interesting meeting in January. And parallel to what we're doing, the Board of Teaching is starting to work on some reading standards. And Senator Olsen, I'll have you talk about that, because this we think is sort of fascinating. And it's also a delicate subject.
Yeah, the Board of Teaching has been operating for about 10 months now, I believe, a task force, and kind of have laid out a framework that will lead to the development of rules for teacher preparation at all levels in terms of the teaching of reading. And that has involved not only the institutions of higher education, but other stakeholders as well in this task forces. And it's kind of revealed some different philosophies and some challenges along the way, and to identify what are the important elements that need to go into rule for changing the way in which we prepare teachers. And so we are having a hearing on that is kind of working to its culmination, that task force, but we are also going to hold a hearing on that teacher preparation as well as staff development. There's a number of teachers that are interested in testifying as well. And so I think we need to hear from them of how well prepared they feel for when they enter the classroom to be able to teach what we know to be effective strategies and the things that need to be learned in terms of literacy and structure of language, and how we can better use our staff development in filling some of the voids for teachers that are feeling that now. So those are the two other areas that we do want to cover before we get to the point of discussion of what kind of, if there's further legislative change. A lot of our focus has been around the law that we already have that does require research-based reading instruction in the five strands of reading areas and in order to achieve being at grade level by grade three. And we've stressed we really mean it. And so that's our goal, is to find out what we're doing that's working, where are some of the where are some of the weak points, what can we do to strengthen those so that both our teaching staff is prepared and not just credentialed but able to be skilled in working with a range of students. And fortunately, we have some very active, involved parents that have had quite a range of experiences with this and that feel very strongly, not just for their children, because they know what they've gone through, but for a broader range of children, that there are things that could be done that could enable reading achievement to proceed at a faster rate and identify the difficulties earlier. I was sharing with Senator Saltzman, I ran into a program that's kind of initiated from here but is operating in a couple places in Texas, and I haven't got the full development, but I had a meeting with one of the university regents that's very involved with this, with some of the Hispanic students, 4- and 5-year-olds, and with their caregivers in the teaching of reading, and it's been highly successful. And so they've been achieving some very major results within a year. And I think there's something that we can be learning from that. I'm going to be getting a follow-up on that, and so maybe we'll be incorporating some of that in our hearings as well. But I think we've uncovered the I was very impressed from that first meeting of the Reach Out and Read program. I think it's just incredible. If when you look at existing kind of resources and people that are willing to get engaged, the pediatric community, they are working with the parent and the child and have had some wonderful success stories of helping the parents become effective in working with their children and getting them engaged in that reading process. And that's, you know, that's a resource that's out there. It isn't something, you know, new necessarily. It just it's there, and it's another ingredient that can get us working together so that children can read.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Olsen.
Well, I have a comment and then a question. I think we all have a passion for education on this committee, but it's been fun to watch Senator Saltzman and Senator Olsen. They are so interested in this RTI and where it could lead. And so I appreciate you guys. But my question kind of talks about unintended consequences. And can you address the special ed, what happens with special ed with the RTI program?
Well, the debate is that I think some of the struggles that are going on right now is that RTI, is it going to be in general education or is it considered special education? Does that make sense? Because RTI, in a perfect world, operates outside of special ed. It's obviously linked to it. But the idea is that we find children earlier, identify them earlier, and try to do specific interventions with them to see if those work. And one of the changes is that before, when children were going to be referred to special ed, it was for basically an IQ test. And that to find the deficiency, usually it didn't show up until third grade, unless you have a child who's extremely disabled. And so where this goes is that you can start to use this RTI, an intervention method, to begin to start the evaluation. So instead of just saying, it's like they're getting service earlier, and saying, if we intervene, do they respond? Because sometimes it's really a learning disability, or like we're just not teaching kids the right way. They're getting services faster. I think the concern we hear from a lot of parents is that under the, you know, on the model that, you know, has been in place since about like the 70s, is that you tell your child, well, when you fall behind, you know, enough, then we can help you. And so parents start to hope, I hope my child falls behind enough to get help, which doesn't really make a lot of sense, but that's kind of how way it's been. So if we can use RTI, it's a way to get services to children, and that should be the main goal. It's not just about saving money or saving paperwork, but it also is something that children who are identified as needing a higher level of intervention can be in a group of children who do have an IEP if they're appropriately placed. But they're not there permanently. It's maybe a temporary placement to see if they respond to the specific reading group, for example. We saw this up at SCRED where one of the children being discussed was just not responding to the different interventions, just sort of a flat line. And that was sort of a red flag for the, you know, the teachers to say this child needs to be evaluated further because they're not responding. Something else is going on. So identifying children earlier who need the more intensive. Does that? So I guess the unintended consequences are that hopefully we help children earlier. they are more successful, saving dollars and resources is you know, a good thing as well.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Olsen, actually the intended consequences are hopefully that if we can improve the instruction of reading using what we know from the research-based methods, that we may, this is their hunches right now, we don't have the full answers, but there are many that have experienced this, even having to work through the special ed model, that we may be able to prevent children from needing to be labeled as learning disabled. And sometimes, in some cases, there is a connection between that and emotional behavioral. Those are our fastest growing areas in special education. And you know what challenges we have in providing the resources there. If we can actually find effective ways that hit a broader base of children and are effective, then I think everybody wins. And that's the intended consequence.
Mr. Chair, it was a loaded question because I knew they could explain it better than I could, but I think Rush City had dropped their special ed identification down to 1.9% of their students, so I think they dropped it by 50% by going to this RTI model. Yeah. So it's very impressive and
persuasive.
But
Senator Saltzman.
But I guess, Mr. Chair, that the problem could be that, and maybe if Mr. Nauman were here, he could help me with this, or maybe somebody can, is there a problem if it's so effective that our funding for special ed, that we don't keep up the level of service that we now have, the maintenance of effort. Now, that would be a horrible problem. But I don't see that happening right away, but that is something that we talked about when we crafted the bill and some of the other funding streams was to make sure that that does not become an issue, the maintenance of effort.
So, Mr. Chairman, then Senator, that just confirms that the challenge when the federal government gets messing in things and it gets in the way of trying to do things effectively. So, I mean, we'll be ready to take on, be loaded for bear.
Mr. Chair, this room is bugged.
Yes, it is.
If I might ask Mr. Nauman the question, when we were working on the RTI, there was some question of maintenance of effort related to services, and I'm a little foggy. Do you remember that discussion?
Mr. Chair and Senator Salzman, I apologize for being a little out of breath. The issue that I think you're talking about, I ran quickly when I heard me. What we're talking about here with the maintenance of effort is that under federal law, if state appropriations drop below where they were in the prior year, there is a federal penalty, and it's a dollar-for-dollar penalty. So the concern is that we need to make sure that I'm more out of breath than I thought I was. We traditionally, when we do the appropriations on special ed, we want to make sure that the dollars don't drop below where they were so that we avoid that penalty. And the penalty also applies to school districts.
But, Mr. Chair, does that enable us to reduce the cross-subsidy required? Does that count? Or is that an overall cost that we have? I mean, if we, in fact, lower the ratio of students needing to be served, we have to plow more students in order to keep that maintenance of effort. How does that work in terms of those numbers?
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, no, I should Ms. McQuay was actually specifying to me that I wasn't specific enough. It is a per pupil calculation. So if the pupils go down, we do make an adjustment for that.
All right. Then we're not in trouble.
Thank you. We're going to go next to Senator Carlson's report, and thank you very much for that update. Senator Carlson, for the technology.
Well, Mr. Chair and committee members, my report's going to be real small because we have not met as yet. We have had lots of problems with getting Senator Jungbauer and myself together to plan, and then after that bridge went down, and we spent a lot of time on transportation. But we are piggybacking on a visit that Senator Saltzman has arranged to her district, and we're going to be looking at a school that has laptops for every student. And that meets with one of the things that we wanted to look at. I visited a couple of places just to find out what we ought to be looking at. And as soon as you mentioned technology, the floodgates open. It's like we can't communicate to other schools. We don't have enough machines for testing. We need to get newer machines. They need to be all the same age instead of having a six-year a replacement cycle or a five-year replacement cycle. We need something that where everything can run on the same software. It's just a host of issues, plus and we got into failed levies. So there's a lot of things that are connected there that we need to look at. Probably the most successful schools, which is one of them in my district in the past, and I believe the one that we're going to be visiting, it's been an ambitious person who has largely gotten a manufacturer to get a pilot agreement so that they can do piloting in that school. And, of course, that becomes then the showpiece for everyone to come and visit. But we're going to be looking at the disparity of capabilities between school districts, primarily on the data manipulation side. And this is the information that is on specific students, and it allows the student records to be transferred with that student to another district. We're also going to be looking at the classroom teaching technologies and what is used in the classrooms to be able to relate to the students, and then also the student-level equipment, and that would be like, you know, are we looking at laptops, are we looking at library computers, just what kinds of things might be needed there. So that's our intents at this time, okay. And I guess if good intentions weigh for anything, then we've done a reasonable job.
Thank you. Questions? We have the upcoming tour set. Senator Saltzman?
Yes, just a comment on that, Mr. Chair. This particular laptop program is an Apple. It's called One-to-One. The children receive a laptop. Beginning of the year, they have it 24/7 from grade 7 to grade 9. And it's been there now for about 4 years, so it has a track record. But the one thing I think when you talk about greater use of staff is that the way that children turn in their paperwork, the way they get it back, it's all by the email. And so teachers are saving 5 to 10 minutes a day of passing papers back and forth, talking with kids that way, and so they have more time in front of the kids. So it's really interesting. Also, the way it's just engaged that particular age group, and how also children who are mainstream from special ed into a regular classroom, you don't even notice those kids because again they're so engaged and they're very much involved. So I really appreciate going out there with this committee. I hope it's a good learning experience. It is a program that they do a lot of training, and what is really exciting but is really sad is that a lot of the districts that are coming to visit this program are from out of state, and almost every private school has been there with the exception of one and is implementing this program. So it's a program that others are recognizing as really, really exciting, and the feedback has been just terrific. So I'm excited to have this committee go.
Good. Any further comments regarding the subcommittee reports? I want to compliment each of you for your work. It's given us a chance to reflect on some very specialized areas that need attention, that will have recommendations going into the 08 session and beyond. Perhaps it's some initial thoughts that we'll put together. That's to be determined in some of the hearings, but you're being very thoughtful, deliberative in that, very appreciative to the extent you've been able to also include the other body in the House to the extent they want to be involved. It helps for putting together a better product. And for anyone in the audience that might have questions, let any of us know. The meetings are open. If there's suggestions that you have, we're very open to that as well. And we have just a couple of minutes if anyone wants to address the committee. If you're here for a particular item that may warrant additional comment from you, that's okay. On the next item for additional policy ideas, we have a few minutes. If there's anything else that you'd like to throw out just for us to be thinking about going into session. I know there's no shortage of things than what we've already identified. I'll mention just a couple of items. You recall that we did have the trip up north for the permanent school fund, mm-hmm. The joint with the House and different DNR interests, and I am having legislation drafted that, whether I carry that or ask someone else to, we will have legislation looking at some recommendations addressing the fund, and I'll have some more information for that in the near future. I'll also probably have legislation addressing P16, P20. We've been talking a lot today about early education, and the point here is, what more can we do to make it a true system where early childhood is linked with K-12 and higher learning? The components need to be more effectively planned. Senator Rummel's looking at some of these issues right now. Nationally, the Education Commission of States has issued a number of things, and we're members of that, and I was appointed to be a rep on that, and they're making this a top priority across America. And here in Minnesota, we have a P16 council, but the legislature is not even on that council. I commend the different stakeholders on that group for getting together, but we as policymakers need to be involved. And so I'll have something on that that I'll be sharing with you. I'm going to talk to Senator Pappas, higher ed chair, which I also serve on that committee, about a joint hearing on that issue as well. And one other item quickly, there's been a lot of discussion about AP recently, and I talked to Senator Pappas about maybe a joint hearing about advanced placement and status in Minnesota and some of the issues that have been raised recently. Senator Salzman.
Thank you. On that point, Mr. Chair, I attended the STEM conference. Some of you, I think, Senator Carlson was there and Olson was there. And you know, I think AP is very interesting. And one of the things, though, that came out of the discussion at the Science Museum was that we had the president from the Boston Museum there. And he used this example of he was teaching at Tufts in the engineering school and talked about how they had these great students coming in as freshmen, and they were signing up for all the, like, you know, the core classes. But at the end of freshman year, they were losing, you know, enough students that they were very concerned about that. They looked at the students' grades. They were all doing well. Why were they dropping out? So they talked to them, and they said, you know, it's boring. And out of that conference really came this sense that we are pushing rigor, but is it a rigor that's engaging kids into these areas? And I see more kids. We are pushing AP classes and rigorous classes, but then I see these kids saying, I don't want to say this again. I am tired of bookwork. I am tired of just learning and not really doing. And so I think that when we talk about AP, I would be very sort of like to hear, how can we make sure that kids are also engaged? Because my sense of having seen high school kids for the past 8 years in my life is that they're just so burnt out sometimes, but they're not engaged. They're, you know, taking these, you know, very difficult classes, but keeping them engaged so that there's an interest in, like, you know, pursuing these key areas that our economy needs.
Mr. Chair, Senator Stump made some reference yesterday in our meeting, too, about the value of restoring some of our focus on career and technical education, because if that's effectively done, it's getting at what this gentleman was also referring to, is that you need to get some of that core engineering applied math and science down earlier so they can see how science and math works in the kinds of things that man has created, not just in the natural science areas, and that's where the interest is captured for engineering. They were going to liberal arts, and, you know, here we've got the void, and we cannot afford in this country to lose those kinds of skills. And I think to some degree we're doing the same thing at the I have nothing against academics and rigor in academics. But if young people aren't making the connection to why it is useful and why it is real, then we're losing the battle. And I think we are going to have to do something with that if we're going to actually focus on our dropout rate, whether it's at the high school level or at the college level.
Good. Well, we will be planning on a joint meeting with higher ed to discuss that as well as some other common issues. So we'll let you know. And on the calendar, we'll ask Gretchen in a little bit to give us an update, but I wanted to welcome our new legislative assistant, Jen Bruntlett. And Jen, if you'd like to tell the committee about yourself.
Sure. I grew up in Painesville, Minnesota, which central Minnesota, St. Cloud area, and went to the University of Minnesota after that. I graduated last December with a double major in international business and economics and political science. So,
what's her name?
Happy to be here. I interned for
Janet,
Congressman Szabo in the spring of 2006 out in D.C. So,
okay, well, welcome aboard.
Thank you.
And Gretchen has been handling all these various subcommittees, and we appreciate all the work and trying to keep that together. And we have a number of meetings coming up, subcommittee, that we talked about on the calendar. And that's before you. If there's questions on that, and maybe any additional details regarding the upcoming tours.
Yeah, one note. There is a typo on the committee calendar for the visit to St. James. That is 11 o'clock. It's marked at 10 o'clock on the committee calendar, but on the subcommittee update, it is at 11. But just
I'm missing what you're
that.
Saying.
Oh, it's
what did you say?
For December 11th.
Okay.
It's 11 o'clock start, not a 12 o'clock start.
Okay, and we'll reissue another
the
one,
Presbyterian
too,
Church?
For everyone.
Yeah, I can send that up this afternoon.
Okay, so we have that change.
Right here.
And then how about the December 4th when we're going to go southern Minnesota?
Yep, that is next Tuesday. The details are still kind of coming forward on that. I've been working with Senator Erickson Ropes and Senator Lynch on that. I'm hoping to have some concrete stuff to be able to send out yet this afternoon. We will for sure have a van that will be traveling down to Spring Valley and then also Plainview. And I believe we're shooting to be back here at the Capitol around 4:30 or so. It'll be an early start, probably about did we say 6:45? About a 6:45 start to leave the Capitol. So we will get those details settled today, though. The other visit that we have coming up, and these details are still firming up, too, is January 7th. We'll be doing Elk River and Osseo that day. And once those details become more concrete, I'll get some more information set out on that. I'm hoping that most of that stuff will be also settled either the end of this week or the first part of next week.
Does it look, though, that January 7th, starting at 2 o'clock, so we can keep our morning open yet?
Yes, the 2 o'clock start will be for sure. That is set. So
we want to make sure Senator Wergen has been scheduled twice, and, of course, the bridge collapse and a couple other things that we had to reschedule. But we're hoping January 7th works for several of you, if not all. And finally, any additional feedback regarding the schedule, the meetings that we have planned? You'll see that we will have additional ones planned in February before session. I recognize some of you will hopefully take some time off, too, before session. But we are going to have opportunities for the committee to further develop recommendations on all the various subcommittee recommendations. I expect we would have a policy omnibus bill this time. And I don't know if we're going to have any money, but there will probably be a bill that Senator Stump will carry as well. But we recognize many of our ideas to be liberated need to go through that committee as well. So thank you, everyone, and we'll see you probably at one of the upcoming subcommittee meetings, and if not, very happy holidays to everyone.
Thank you.
Committee's adjourned. Yes, if you have your forms.